This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we take a look at some of the stories to come out of the 2018 Farnborough International Air Show, including the orders, the Boeing NMA, engines to power it, the Airbus A220, and a startup airline. In the news, we look at the Ryanair strikes, the top 10 airlines, United flight attendants preparing to pitch the airline's credit card in the Airbus A321LR and XLR. Also, we have an interview with the director of the Portland International Jetport and an important announcement. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 513 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Max. I am back from an awful lot of stuff. I did sort of jump around and listen to the show last week, so I'm really happy that you played the segment with Nikki and myself. We went flying, and as you could tell from the segment I recorded, we had a fantastic time.
Yeah, and that was a big surprise, too. When I got that, when you sent that in, I was really thrilled to see that you two had gotten connected and you had a firsthand opportunity to experience Nikki's flying skills. That's pretty cool, Brian. Pretty cool.
It was fun.
All right. Well, David Vanderhoof is on a business trip, so he won't be joining us. And Max Trescott is off at Air Venture Oshkosh, having probably more fun than he deserves. So we have some special co-hosts with us. First, we have our main man, Micah.
Yay! Good evening, Max. Hello, Brian. So nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. And in addition to Micah, we have Benay Wilson, the aviation queen. Hi, Benay.
Yay!
Hello. All hail the queen.
Long live the queen.
Benay, we missed you at the National Air and Space Museum in June, but we'll have to get caught up this episode.
Yes, I'm still bitter about that, but I saw that it was very successful, and I enjoyed listening to all of the show.
Great. Well, this episode is going to be a little bit different in some ways. We've got some aviation news, just general stuff that's been going on, and then we're going to talk about some things that came out of Farnborough this year. Instead of a guest, Micah has a conversation recorded that he had done with the airport director of Portland International Jetport. We've got a few other things planned as well, so stick with us. But first, we have the news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready.
Ready up here.
First story is from Reuters. Ryanair says biggest ever strike to ground 600 flights next week. Well, Ryanair's had some serious labor issues lately. Micah, what's happening over at Ryanair?
Well, it's with their cabin crew. And, you know, we're friends with some people that have worked in their cabin crew. And it's a very difficult place to work. Being cabin crew any place is a difficult place to work, as anybody who does it can attest. But recently, the cabin crew put out a list of demands, 34 demands that call for things that seem minor to me. And this is why I put the story in there, like a fair living wage, some sick pay, contracts that are written in a language based on where they're from rather than on Irish law. And, you know, they complained about things like having to pay for drinking water during flights and have to physically report to work when they're sick to provide written details of their symptoms and why they're sick. It just seems like typical Ryanair policy and mishigas, as we like to say in Yiddish.
Micah, that's just crazy talk. What worker rights. I can't believe you. Yeah, no, as I've always said, it's the job of the flight attendants to save my ass, not kiss it. And I have so much respect for these people and the job that they do and things like being paid a livable wage. Certainly something that I wholeheartedly support them and their efforts to get fairly compensated for the great job that they do.
Well, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I know how hard cabin crew work. But what I think what's really interesting is that it seems like the floodgates have opened, you know, after the pilots went through their round with Ryanair. So I think this has kind of emboldened cabin crew to say, hey, wait a minute, they got theirs. It's time for us to get our piece of the pie. So it's going to be really interesting. There's going to be some pain before this is resolved.
Of course, Ryanair just recently published a list of what they thought were cabin crew benefits. They published this on Twitter, and they say that their staff have some of the best conditions in Europe's low-cost airline sector. But I think there's a difference of opinion with the cabin crew. And, you know, as we mentioned, there's also been a problem with the pilots also taking some labor actions as well. It's maybe is affecting the bottom line. CNN reported, I think just today, that Ryanair's first quarter profit dropped 20% over previous year. Ryanair says it's because of higher fuel costs, rising wages, and strikes by pilots and regional air traffic controllers. But the action by the cabin crew certainly is, I think, going to have an effect if it hasn't already. And a lot of people are impacted by this, too. They expect almost 50,000 customers to be impacted with this current action. And the 600 flights refers to the 2 days, July 25th and 26th. And Ryanair thinks they'll end up canceling 300 flights or up to 300 flights each of those 2 days. That's where you get to the 600 flights in the Reuters headline.
So what do you think Mr. O'Leary will do, Binet? You know the airline industry better than any of us. Do you think he'll impose a cabin crew fee?
Yes, right after they do the overhead bin lock fee and the restroom fee.
Yeah.
Yeah, and here, Max, didn't I see that they earned 1.45 billion euros in profit for the quarter? I think that if the airline wasn't making as much money as they had, this wouldn't be as big of a deal. But for the airline to say that they're the best of the low-cost airlines, to me, that's like saying, well, my employees in the salt mine are treated the best of all the salt mine workers. You know, if conditions are really, really bad, just being the best of the bad isn't really a great place to be.
No. That's called the cream of the crap.
That's pretty good. Well, yeah, one thing they don't make is the list of the top world's best airlines. And in fact, we have an article from our In Airfare Watchdog, and they report on the 2018 Skytrax World Airline Awards. Micah, I bet Ryanair isn't on that list.
No, I did not. Well, I'm not sure if they're there. I haven't gone through the 100 because I got the whole list in front of me. But what I found was interesting is you had to get down to number 30 to get to North America. And then you had to get down to number 37 before you got to a U.S. carrier.
That's right. Delta comes in at a not very respectable 37th place. Followed by Alaska at 38th, JetBlue at 42nd, Southwest at 57th, Hawaiian at 77th, American at 79th, and United at 88th place.
And actually, Ryanair was better than United in that Skytrax ranking. So, yeah, well done, United.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
64 is where they are, is where Ryan is.
Number one is, as you might suspect, Singapore Airlines, and this is reportedly the fourth time they've been number one, followed by number two, Qatar. ANA is third, Emirates fourth, Eva Air, then Cathay Pacific, Lufthansa, Hainan Airlines at eighth, Garuda International at ninth, and Thai Airways at 10th. And this World Airline Awards, it actually goes back to 1999 is when they launched it. In the year 2000, they had 2.2 million survey entries. And in this most recent survey, it comes from just a little over 20 million entries. So it's pretty broad-based in terms of trying to collect the traveler's opinion.
Well, we were just discussing this list, and we were talking about how low the U.S. carriers are on this list. And, you know, and Max, you mentioned the 20 million people who had taken the survey. I don't downplay the Skytrax list because I think it's served as a good marker. But these are also pretty subjective, and you think about the airlines that people fly regularly. That's my one point. The other point is the U.S. carriers don't have the, well, I'm not going to say they don't have the money. They are not investing nearly as heavily in their passenger experience as some of these other ones in the top 10. I've flown on five of these top 10, and you'd be hard-pressed to see a U.S. carrier doing a lot of the things that these carriers are doing.
That's a really good point. The U.S. carriers don't try to do exactly what the Singapore Airlines and Qatar's and Emirates and those folks do.
The one thing about this list, do we know, do the people that fill out the survey, do they have to have flown on the airline, or is it just their opinion of the airline?
Good question.
Yeah, and to Binet's point over it being so subjective, there are airlines like Lufthansa that have a, I think, fantastic first-class product, a very good business-class product. I think their economy product really needs some help. So I don't know if I'd put them in number seven. EVA, for example, definitely have to give a shout-out to them. I've flown on them several times, and I think that across all the product offering, they have a really good product. I know Singapore has spent a tremendous amount of money going through a transformation, and I think they've probably earned this number one spot this year. But in years past, I've always questioned, are people voting Singapore so high because of their reputation as opposed to the actual product that they're doing?
Yeah, I flew on Singapore last fall. I literally did a round-the-world trip on three of their different aircraft. And it had been a while since I've flown on them, and they have definitely raised their game. And this was, I want to say, toward the tail end of some of the things that they were doing to enhance their cabin. And I wanted to try all three classes, which I did. I thought their premium economy product was amazing. Business and first were both good, too. What surprised me, I was just looking at this list again. Where's Etihad?
Number 15.
Wow.
Yeah, but again, if it's an opinion piece as opposed to...
An experience piece.
Yeah, an experience piece. That, to me, it would definitely change some of these rankings, I think. But I must say, I'm looking forward to flying Singapore later on this year on the Newark to Singapore flight. So 19-hour experience I'm signing myself up for.
Great.
And again, enthusiastically looking forward to that flight.
And you've done that flight before, haven't you, Brian, on the old A340?
Yeah, years and years ago, yeah. Which I didn't have that great of a time. I had issues with the seat. They were built for people significantly, in my opinion, they were built for people smaller than 6 foot tall. And with my back, I really have to have the back upright, and I like raising my legs. And in that configuration of the seat, it was impossible to raise your legs and keep the back upright. The back had to recline in some relationship to the leg. And that just wasn't good for me.
All right, well, let's push on and talk about the travel news website Skift that reports starting in September, United is going to be joining other airlines in pushing their branded credit card to passengers. In fact, flight attendants will receive $100 if they sign up a customer. Micah, this is, well, of course, credit cards, that part of the business is generally pretty lucrative for airlines, I think.
It is very lucrative. I actually wrote a story, and I put it in the show notes, but I wrote a story back in March for Magnify Money on just how lucrative these cards are. And I knew that it was pretty lucrative, but it was hard to find information because the airlines don't say you have to really dig. And I found a slide from Delta's investor relations presentation from 2014, and they valued their multi-year contract with American Express at $2 billion. That's wow. not anything to sneeze at. And United just unveiled the new Explorer credit card. I just did a roundup story on Southwest's new Priority credit card. This is big business for airlines. And if flight attendants can get that $100 incentive, that's just money toward the bottom line.
Yeah, but how annoying is it for the passengers to listen to these commercials? And I'm so against having the flight attendants do this. And I asked my friends who work in the United Club if they are going to be compensated for selling the card. And the answer right now is no, they're not. If someone picks up an application and fills it out in the club, they don't get compensated for it. So it's only an onboard product with United, or at least so far. And again, I'd say congratulations that they're not doing it in the club, because I want this to be my place of sanctuary. I don't want to be sold to there.
I have no problem with any airline selling a card. And in fact, I used to work for a large retailer here in Maine when they first started issuing their own credit card with a bank. And I know how profitable it is. And if the airlines are making money, that means my fees are going to go down. But what I don't care for, what bothered me about it, was the fact that the flight attendant was going to be getting what, in the, if you're a salesman, is called a spiff for pushing it, which means I'm going to be pushed. I'm going to be asked to sign up for it while I'm on there, and I'm not going to be able to relax. And I don't like the fact that I'm being sold something while I'm sitting on the airplane. I'm already being sold by looking at their magazine or signing up for whatever. I don't want to be sold by an individual and feel pressured.
I guess there's a line, and everybody has a different line, maybe. For me, you know, being sold to a little is okay, but there's some point at which it becomes, yeah, annoying. But if I was a flight attendant and have the opportunity to win or to receive $100 per customer that I sign up, boy, I'm going to be motivated to hone my salesman skills as much as I could.
No, absolutely. And that's why they're making it $100, because, and it's up from 50. Money motivates people to do things. I'm just looking at it from the customer perspective, whereas that's the last that mid-flight, I don't want them coming on the PA system and walking up and down the aisle with credit card applications and disturbing me either while I'm working or while I'm sleeping. It's the last thing I want.
Did we just find the solution for Ryanair?
Oh, boy. No, but I understand what you're saying about the announcements. I did a flight on Spirit Airlines, and they were pushing the card, and I had forgotten, because it's been so long since I've heard those announcements, I had forgotten how annoying they can be. But on the other hand, you know, the airline has to make money, and you people refuse to pay higher fares.
Yeah. All right, Airbus. This is from Motley Fool. An Airbus 321XLR could be a game changer for JetBlue. Well, before we get to the XLR, JetBlue has the option to convert some of their orders for A321neos to LRs. And those have a range of up to 4,000 nautical miles. Now, they have to give Airbus 24 months notice if they want to convert some of their options, and they haven't done that yet. JetBlue is thinking about, you know, where can they make the greatest margins with an LR or long-range aircraft. They could look through transatlantic flights, but do they want to do that, or do they want to focus on domestic flights? Where can they generate the greatest margins? But there is the possibility now of an A321XLR that has an even greater range, a 4,500-mile range. And so this adds something a little more to JetBlue's thinking as to what their strategy should be.
You know, and our good friend Cranky Flyer, Brett Snyder, did an article recently about JetBlue, too, and their strategies, and the fact that not only is the XLR a good choice based on them being able to get into a lot of Europe from Boston to New York, their two biggest hubs, but by getting, they placed orders this month in Farnborough. I'm not sure if it's in our show notes later on, but for the A220, both 100 and 300. And that's going to extend your range considerably from the E190s that they have now. And they're going to be able to get all the way down with that. They can get into Ireland. They can get down into South America. Well, they're already in South America, but much further down into South America, almost into Brazil.
That's right. And so that's, you know, there's more opportunities. And, you know, there's a lot of things that have to happen. I think Airbus isn't yet committed to the XLR, but it could launch in the not too distant future if Airbus chooses to do that. The first LR, the 321 LR, goes to TAP Air Portugal, TAP Air Portugal, by the end of this year. And, you know, when we talk about these long-range A321s, we start to get into the, you know, the territory that Boeing is looking at with their NMA, their 757 replacement, quote-unquote. It presents a really interesting competitive question.
Yeah, well, for these really long flights in a single-aisle aircraft, from a passenger experience, they're just not great. And when you're pushing the aircraft that far, right, they're talking about a 4,500-mile range, the flights to South America from Fort Lauderdale being 4,000 to 4,400 miles. It's only 100 miles of reserve for diversion, at least by using these numbers. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I'd be wanting to sign up first to be on that aircraft.
Well, this is, I mean, we can start to talk about some of the things that came out at Farnborough, but this is really kind of an interesting issue from a Boeing and an Airbus standpoint. Is Boeing contemplates an NMA, and we hear now that they're going to, or they expect to make a decision in 2019, whether that's early in 2019 or the end of 2019, different people are speculating at each end of the year. But there's a lot of considerations to be made, both for Boeing and also for Airbus with the A321. I mean, Boeing's got to look at what the airlines are telling them they want. Boeing's got to consider what Boeing thinks the airlines need, which may or may not be the same thing. They need to look at the engineering resources that it would take. Do you look at a development of an existing aircraft, or you do a clean sheet of paper? You've got to look at what about engine options and what is the capacity of the engine manufacturers to develop something new. There's a lot of interesting things to be considered.
Well, the XLR, it looks like from the article, it's for me, I'm guessing that it's more of a stopgap measure in order to get things going a little more quickly and maybe not sell as many as they might want, because it's going to be available or could be available as soon as 2022. And if Boeing's not looking at the NMA until 2019, when are we going to see it? 2026? So there's like a four-year period where the XLR could be the aircraft of choice.
And some of this can also be sort of posturing in the press in order to influence the decision that your customers may make relative to what the competitor is saying their product and timing is. So it's really difficult to tell what's actually going to happen in these kind of things. But one thing that came out at Farnborough that was kind of interesting from and this was in Flight Global. CFM to compete for NMA, even if required thrust rises. Of course, Boeing has a some kind of an agreement with CFM International for CFM engines on the 737s, and we don't know what that agreement is. At the same time, the two components of CFMI, that being GE Aviation and Safran in France, have some kind of an agreement. We don't know what it is that determines the scope over which they'll collaborate to develop engines. And apparently, that agreement, it seems, includes a limit of 50,000 pounds of thrust for the engine. So, in other words, CFM International won't go after a bigger market and poach on the, you know, the engines of GE Aviation. But what we're seeing here is reported that CFM is saying that, well, if it, you know, if the NMA needs an engine that's a little, you know, a little bit more than 50,000 pounds of thrust, you know, we're still going to go for that. I thought that was a, you know, a very interesting statement to make.
Yeah, you always wonder what kind of backroom deals are going on between GE and I can't, what was the name of the other?
Safran.
Safran, yeah. You know, so, okay, so, yeah, you make 60, but maybe we can do 55. It's 58 too much, and all the negotiations that are taking place.
Yeah, you're right, Micah. There are just a lot of conversations that tends to go on in this industry that, you know, is never reported, never will be. And maybe every industry is like that, but it certainly happens in ours. Of course, at Farnborough, people love to tally up the aircraft orders. How many did Boeing get? How many did Airbus get? One of the difficulties is how do you measure these things? And different people measure these orders differently. I mean, you think that it would be easy to measure, well, did you get an order or not? Well, it may be an order that had really previously gone on the books, but the operator wasn't mentioned. Sometimes they save that for Farnborough. You got orders versus options. There's just a lot of different ways to measure it. But in ATW Online, they've got an article here. Airbus and Boeing gained more than 960 aircraft orders at Farnborough, valued at $160 million at list price.
Billion, sorry.
Yeah. Although the actual price paid may be closer to the, you know, the lower number. But the list prices, of course, is a fiction.
Yeah, you know, a billion here, a billion there. Soon you're talking about real money.
That's right. That's right.
I think one of the interesting things, Max, and you brought this up about the numbers, it would be really interesting if somebody went back and looked at the past 10 years and saw and just did a measure of just how much of the business announced at air shows actually came to fruition.
Yes. That would be fascinating. And I bet there's a wide divergence. Maybe not every year, but I'm sure they're different numbers. Orders can get canceled. You know, orders for one thing can turn into something else. They can get deferred. Just all these things can happen. But it's kind of amusing, at least it is for me, to watch Farnborough and the Paris Air Show and the few others, just to see the different companies vie for the best headlines.
Yeah, Max, there's an article that I was reading from the Motley Fool, and their line is, but most of the deals it announced were commitments that still need to be finalized rather than firm orders. So what's, you know, it's like, how do you define a commitment versus a firm order? When does it become a firm order? These numbers are, to me, they just all seem so fake, and all the double and triple counting that goes on. It seems like they're writing these press releases for the headlines as opposed to reality.
Yeah.
And the article also concludes with talking about the component shortage, and I think really what they're referring to are seats and engines. And certainly in the A320 market and 737 market, the manufacturers are having a really difficult time. And so the quote is, but unless the two aerospace giants can satisfy that demand in a timely fashion by rising production further, the annual order race will remain a somewhat meaningless contest.
Yeah, when you have backlogs like they do.
Right, it just doesn't matter.
No, I remember I was just thinking about what Micah just said about all these orders and different expressions. I remember in the mid-90s when Fairchild Dornier was still around, and they made an announcement that Lufthansa and I think it was Swiss Air, had announced, and I quote, expression of desire for the 728 jet.
How firm is that?
Well, I'm going to skip a minute, if you don't mind, Max, because this sort of goes along with what you were saying, and that's the story that we have here, the United orders E-175s. And I just found that fascinating. I put it in there because United may be ordering E-175s, but they're not ordering them for themselves. They're ordering them for Mesa. And so who knows what's going on with that and how that all works out.
Yeah, these are the SC variant, right, of the E175s,
right.
25 of them. There's an issue with the configuration. The SC variant, that's configured with 70 seats as opposed to the normally what you see with that plane, the 76 seats. And I think this revolves around scope clause.
Yeah, it's a union thing, and that's, you know, the size that they have to go with. But they're ordering, you know, the SC version, not even the E175-2, which is the latest version with a better fuel burn, from what I understand. But they're not ordering them for themselves. They're ordering them for their subcarriers, you know, and their connection fleets. And I can't quite figure out how that works. And maybe you have a better idea. Maybe somebody can explain it to me.
Yeah, but from a passenger perspective, I'm actually happy that they're ordering the aircraft and putting less seats in them, which that'll mean greater legroom. So yeah. It'll be a more comfortable experience.
Well, and they're getting rid of replacing the CRJ-700s, which are just not very comfortable either.
Well, we see here that the scope clause that United has with its pilots limits the number of large regional jets, with large meaning 70 to 76 seats, to 255 of them. So there's a fixed number of them, which is kind of interesting. And that includes 102 70-seaters and 153 76-seaters. So that's how you get to the 255. But ALPA, the Airline Pilots Association, they're looking at this. There's a quote in there from them. This aircraft is designed to hold over 80 seats and will be flown to outsourced express carriers in the 70-seat configuration. This is from the United chapter of ALPA. Quoting again, revenue plummets and costs skyrocket. Bringing this flying back to mainline United Airlines will lower costs, increase revenue, and allow United to once again control its product. So the union has a problem with this, an issue. But scope clause, I don't know. I just always, my head always spins when it comes to scope clause. It just seems like pilots disagree, but it just seems like a kind of a funny way to operate a business.
Yeah, a good but antiquated process.
Yeah, let's just all play nice and think about the consumer and, you know, less about who gets to fly what. But I know I'll get a lot of hate mail for that one. We've talked about the A220, right? The airliner previously known as the Bombardier C-Series, now under the Airbus family and named the A220. A couple of news items relating to that. One is gaining ETOPS certification. Of course, on the A220, the engine is sole source, Pratt & Whitney's geared turbofan. And there was an announcement that's been cleared for ETOPS operations up to 3 hours. ETOPS, of course, being extended twin engine operations. And we have seen some activity with the A220 lately, with some orders, and that's great news, I think. It's hard to say at this point, you know, being an outsider, if the interest that we're seeing now, the orders that we're seeing now, is a result of Airbus's involvement, or if this is stuff that was already in the pipeline and the deals were really already consummated. Don't know. Maybe they were in the pipeline and maybe Airbus came in with, you know, the financial push that put them over the line.
I'm sure there was a lot of competition back and forth, because it's the A220's main competition, I think, is the E190. And the E195 from Embraer. And I suspect that, JetBlue was certainly in the market for new aircraft. And I bet you someone said, well, we can make you a deal. And that's one good reason why it was chosen, besides the fact that it certainly has a longer range and it's supposed to be hold more passengers and be more fuel efficient.
Well, it seems like the geared turbofan keeps coming up lately. Of course, the E-Jets, the Embraer E-Jets, are powered by geared turbofan engines. The Bombardier are. And we talked about the new airline that the founder of JetBlue, David Neeleman, is talking about creating. And that's going to be flying. We talked about this 60 Airbus A220-300. So, of course, those are Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engines for those as well. So there was a memorandum of understanding signed at the Farnborough show where some, quote, experienced investors plan to start the new airline. So it looks like that's moving forward.
Yeah, and again, that's part of what Cranky wrote about when he talked about JetBlue buying the A220s, because it can probably feed down into South America where their founder is starting a new airline.
And is that the airline that'll be called Moxie?
Yes, which is a drink up here in Maine.
Yeah, I was going to say, it just seems like a bizarre name. To name it after a soft drink.
It takes a lot of moxie to be sparkling like that.
Well, I think it's just a placeholder name. I mean, I remember when JetBlue started, it was New Air. So I think this is just a placeholder. Please let it please.
Yes,
just a
good
placeholder. Please.
Hopefully. Air Taxi. Boy, that's in the news a lot. Everybody is developing... seems to be developing autonomous or not air taxis, personal aircraft of various sorts. And another announcement that came out at Farnborough, this was also an AIN online, GoFly personal air taxi competition racks up support. Now, GoFly sponsor Boeing is now joined by Pratt & Whitney as a sponsor. GoFly, it was launched in 2017, late 2017, September, and it's sort of a contest where they're looking to promote and create personal aircraft that can fly people 20 miles, I think, is the objective, without recharging or refueling, and using VTOL, vertical takeoff and landing, or close to it kind of capability. So the announcement here was that Pratt & Whitney sponsoring the $100,000 Disruptor Award for the most innovative team in the competition. It's an interesting competition because it occurs in stages over the course of 2 years. In total, teams are competing for $2 million in prizes. But what they've just done now is announce the Phase 1 winners, and there's 10 winners in this Phase 1.
You know, what fascinates me about this is that, you know, we've been talking about it for a long, long time in the personal taxis. And will the personal taxis be made available physically before we have regulations for them? Or are we going to finally come up with regulations for them? Because right now, if they came into play, they couldn't fly.
Yeah, the regulatory angle is really key to this. I mean, there's the technology, there's the automation, there's public acceptance, there's a variety of different things. But in the end, you're right, Micah, if the regulations aren't in place, everything I think comes to a full stop.
Yeah, it just it always amazes me as to which direction these go in. You know, we sort of went backwards, and you and David talk about this on UAV all the time. You know, the UAVs came out, they were all there, and all of a sudden the FAA said, oh my gosh, we need regulations. And when they came up with it, they hurt a lot of people and made some mistakes. Is this going to go the same way, or will we learn?
It's a good question. It's a timing thing. I think the FAA is trying to generate first the data that it needs so that it can create the regulations, or the proposed regulations anyway, so that this technology can proceed, and so this industry can proceed. At the same time, you've got Congress trying to give some direction through the FAA reauthorization process. And lately, I know you could. We're not supposed to talk politics because we get in trouble. But anyway, so yeah, so you know whether this all comes together at the same point or not is difficult. But we'll have a link to the winners, the 10 winners of this Phase 1 of the GoFly Challenge in the show notes. And in fact, there's a video in there that also talks about the Phase 1 winners. But it's an interesting collection. This first 10 includes most of the teams are from the United States. There's one from Latvia, which is the ERA Avia bike. It's a tilt rotor aerial vehicle,
which looks really cool.
Yeah, some of these things are really, now these are just concepts, so you know.
Yep.
But they're pretty cool looking. From the UK, Team Leap offered up the Vantage 5 rotor air bike. Let's see, some of the others, the Scoop, that's a US plane, Pegasus Y6 tilt rotor with a wing and a hybrid powertrain. There was one from Japan. Let's see, what? The Tetra.
Or Tetra.
Yeah, I think the Tetra 3. Not only efficient enough, but also stylish enough to meet commercial requirements.
That's important.
Yeah.
You know, and if you go down to the bottom of the article, it talks about how, you know, only Boeing and Pratt & Whitney are offering competition cash prizes. There's a bunch of trade and professional sponsors, and it's really an amazing group of organizations. It's the Royal Aeronautics Society, GAMA, AOPA, AIAA, EAA, Flight Safety Foundation. I can't name them all, but I mean, it's a really great group of sponsors. It's the whole aerospace industry in there. So something's going to happen. I hope we come up with a way to be able to fly in them if they should ever come out.
Yeah, and this is a fun. It is a fun method for generating interest, generating research, you know, all of those things that can lead to results that we may not even anticipate. I mean, some of the things that come out of this may lead to other product categories that aren't even within the scope here. You never know.
And it's exciting for us as airplane geeks, but I think exciting is a word because it's exciting for even non-geeks, too.
Yes, yes. Now, each of these 10 teams receives $20,000 for being chosen under phase one. And the next phase is the building phase. So we start to see some actual aircraft, I guess. Interestingly enough, even if you're one of the top 10 phase one prize winners, it's not limited to those 10 for the next phase. So, in other words, you don't need to win a phase one prize or to even have participated in phase one in order to participate and win in phase two. So we may see some other teams come in with some other ideas. So this is a fun one to take a look at in the show notes, just to look at the designs and the sort of the creativity that's going on here. Well, one item that we have to mention from the Farnborough Air Show is the display, the aerial display that was put on by the Lockheed Martin LM-100J, which, if you're not aware of it, it's basically the civilian version of the C-130 Hercules. Now they've had a C-130 version for civil use for some time, the Lockheed L-100. In fact, that goes way back to 1964. And there were several versions that were developed. But the L-100 production ended in 1992. This new updated model, the LM-100J, just completed its first flight about a year ago in May 2017. But did you guys see this video? Did you see what they did with this, essentially the C-130?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. Micah, when you and I were there 2 years ago and we saw the A380 dance around the skies, we both were thoroughly impressed with that. But this, geez, yeah, that put the poor little A380 to shame, didn't it?
It was just amazing to see in video, and I'm sorry we weren't there to see it in person this time, but it says in the headline that it does a roll. It was no roll. It did a loop, and it just proves that C-130 can do anything, and I wish David were here to comment on it because it's one of his favorites.
That was just amazing.
Kind of spectacular. So look for a video of that in the show notes, or just look on YouTube and search for that. You'll find that for sure.
But, you know, I asked our friend Captain Rick, who's a former C-130 pilot. He just moved to the C-17. I asked him, could you do that? And he hasn't gotten back to me yet.
Yeah, come on, Rick. We want to hear if you're capable of doing that or if you've ever done that, actually.
Yeah, if he has done. Yeah, exactly. There's another video on YouTube, and there are a lot, but there's one entitled The Best of Farnborough Air Show 2018. It's a 15-minute-long video that just has a bunch of really great scenes of a whole bunch of different aircraft, kind of a highlights reel. So if you have 15 minutes to look through some video, that's definitely worth your time.
All right. Well, very good. At this point, we'd like to talk about this interview, Micah, that you did with Paul Bradbury from the Portland International Jetport. We're gonna play this recording, but just why don't you tee it up for us a little bit?
Well, I had met Paul Bradbury a couple of times. In fact, I did a quick little phone-in thing back when Ampanay was giving us the phone number all the time about a tour of the expansion of the Jetport that happened a few years ago. And then recently I attended an airport noise advisory committee meeting, and Paul was there, and he was educating the public as to what noise was happening from the airport and how to deal with it and why it takes place. And we talked again a little bit more, and I spoke up quite a bit at that meeting, as you'll hear. And I said, you know, maybe it would be a good idea to see if I could set up a time to talk with him and learn a little bit more about PWM. So we got in touch. He invited me down to the office, and I apologize in advance for the quality of the interview, because I did it on a microphone plugged into my iPhone, and we were sitting in the office, and it was sitting on the table, and Paul gets really excited and exuberant, as you'll hear, and he was bang on the table a little bit, so we moved it, but it picked up everything. But I think we'll learn a lot about the airport here, so why don't we go to the interview?
We're here at the Portland Jetport, PWM, Portland Westbrook Municipal, with Paul Bradbury, the airport director. And Paul, thank you so much for deciding to work with me and talk a little bit on the airplane geeks. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Mike. Really a pleasure to be with you today.
It's wonderful to have you. And, you know, you've been here a long time, and we've met before in a couple of different places and a few crazy tours, and you've known I've been an airplane geek even before I was officially associated with the podcast. And you're one, too, which is just great. But let me ask you a couple of just beginning questions. How long have you been here at PWM? It's been a couple of years, hasn't it?
It has been a few years. So I started in August of 92. So people that do their math quickly will recognize that I've been here for 26 years come this August.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a great run, and I've been airport director since 2008.
Well, happy anniversary to that. It's great. And a lot of things have happened over those years. But, you know, I also happen to know from another tour that I took, we may talk to that in a little bit, your background is in engineering, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I'm a licensed professional engineer for mechanical engineering in the state of Maine. And this is a great business, and it gives you an appreciation. The engineering gives you an appreciation for the aircraft and all that goes into that side of the equation. So it's been a really good balance to have that engineering background and start out here as the engineering manager and then to move into being a director.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is how did you end up with a degree in engineering and being a licensed engineer in the state of Maine, which is not an easy thing to do, at an airport?
So it is really interesting, and there are a few. There's another director, Iftikhar, down in Providence, Rhode Island, is also an engineer as well and a professional engineer. But we are in the minority, for sure, of airport directors in the country. So I started in the engineering and facilities here in Portland, and from there really got to understand and really be passionate about aviation. And it was great. And it really led to, you know, that passion. And one of the things you learn as an engineer is part of making the airport move forward is getting these projects and getting them funded. And that moved me more to the administrative side. Because the projects are great, but then you come back and it's all about the money oftentimes, and finding that and getting it promoted and getting it in place. So a lot of my work became that, and that's really how it transitioned more to the finance and administration side.
Well, that leads me right to my next question, which is, you know, the Portland, well, it's called Portland West, the PWM is the abbreviation,
yes.
Portland Westbrook Municipal. Nobody calls it that. It's the Portland Jetport. It's been the Jetport for a long time, but what's really interesting about the Jetport is that it's located in two cities.
Yes.
It's in Portland, Maine, and South Portland, Maine, two very separate, two very individual cities with two different governments. How do you end up funding the airport and manage and operate it based on the governmental perspective in the two cities you have to deal with, as well as many others under other circumstances?
So that's a great question. So the city of Portland, Maine, actually owns and operates the Portland International Jetport. So surprisingly enough, the city of Portland, Maine, owns the land in South Portland that becomes the entire campus. So it's just like any other landholder that might own land in South Portland. It just happens that the city of Portland owns that land on the other side. Where it gets really tricky, though, is when you build something on the airport campus, it may or may not go to one, you know, it may or may not be the city of Portland's planning board. You're likely going to the city of South Portland's planning board for many projects to get them approved and get them through that process. So it is really interesting. And obviously projects that are private and that we work with that are private development, the taxes that are generated in South Portland stay in South Portland. You know, all that property tax and private investment is on that side. So the stuff on the Portland goes to the other side. So it is very interesting, and the line is not clean. It's a very kind of funky property boundary that goes between the two, the Portland and South Portland. I don't know why, but our primary runway is predominantly on the South Portland, or nearly all on the South Portland side, 1129.
So when it comes to development, you have two masters.
We do.
That's got to be crazy.
So our board of directors is the City of Portland Council. They're our board of directors. They do the appropriation. My boss is the city manager, John Jennings, for the City of Portland. So they are our governing body, even if we were a private business. We're an enterprise fund of the City of Portland. So that's where we take our projects. But when we go to build something in South Portland, it still has to go to their regulatory approval.
You know, you said 26 years, that's a long time. And the airport has changed dramatically over those 26 years. Just you've expanded it in so many different ways. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about some of those changes. What comes to mind when you start thinking about all those changes, both physically and well, from whatever perspective you want to bring it up from?
You know, it's been really a lot of fun. I want to start with that. It's been a fun time. I came into the Portland International Jetport. The reality is it's not that long after deregulation. And when I got here, we actually had two checkpoints. We had one down on the lower level and one upstairs. It wasn't the same that it is today, and people might be surprised. There was not even a restroom on the security side, the secured side of the checkpoint back then. You had to just go in and out of the checkpoint to go to the bathroom. You had to leave the gate concourse just to find a restroom.
I remember that. I moved to Portland, Maine in 1987. And
the
first time I flew in here was in August of 87. And it was like, wow, this is great. It's a wonderful airport with wonderful facilities, but really small.
It was really small. So you think about that. We didn't have a restroom on the secured sterile gate concourse side until 1995. So very interesting. So when I got here, it was a much smaller building, and the building that existed started from the original 1967 terminal when they moved from the Portland Municipal Airport up where Northeast Air, and that building no longer exists, on Yellowbird Road and Westbrook Street, to a brand new building in 1967. I certainly wasn't here at that time, but that was the initial terminal. They expanded it in 78 and 1980. I come in 1992. A lot of that infrastructure was very much outdated and in need of improvement. So what a fun time to come to a small airport when we needed a lot. We had a small parking garage, one supported deck that had drivable ramps that must have been designed by somebody in Florida that never met snow. They were way too steep for a snow market. One of the first things we did is remove and rebuild that structure with an internal ramping system so that the ramps were shallower and not so steep. I mean,
it sounds like it was an engineer's dream, really,
it
in terms
really
of
was.
What you were able to do.
So from there, we had large expansions that came of the terminal. We're sitting in a room for the listeners. They can't see. It's actually my office. But the terminal used to end at the wall of my office. I know listeners can't see that, but there's no window there anymore. It's the majority of the terminal is that direction now. But when I started here, that was the end of the building. And the portion of the building that goes beyond that wasn't done until 1995. The big project that we have, and the one that's really was wonderful for me, was one that we started design work on in 2008, and that is what we've now referred to as the terminal expansion, because it was our biggest one in the history. 130,000 square feet. What you see now when you go to the ticketing or the security screening checkpoint is that project. It was the biggest one in the history of the airport for us.
I remember when you did that tour of the big terminal expansion. I was part of that, and one of the things that amazed me about it was that it was so environmentally friendly. And if I remember correctly, it was the first, and it may still be the only airport that's geothermal in heating and cooling. I think you worked with Mechanical Services to put that together. I can't remember. Was that the company?
So Mechanical Services was one of the, and they did the controls. They did a lot of the controls, and but it was, that is a wonderful part. So the overall project actually achieved LEED Gold. Only the second airport terminal in the country to achieve that level of leadership and energy efficient design, which is the LEED criteria. We were beat by roughly a month by San Francisco, but San Francisco didn't have geothermal, to your point. There are other airports, and actually Rockland is smaller, but they did a geothermal in about the same time frame we were, which is great. That system heats and cools the building, and it really uses the ground as a thermal heat sink. I'll be careful on my mechanical engineering terms, but I get a real kick out of that one. There's 22.7 miles of pipe that form that system. And it's really just HDPE, high density polyethylene pipe into the ground, grouted in to be these large heat transfer into the ground. So we either take heat from the ground, or we, in the summer, where it is now, a warm day, we dump heat in the ground. So really, it was a great process and helped us to achieve that LEED Gold.
Well, you've always been environmentally friendly. And this year, one of the other projects that you did was you started recycling
aircraft de-icing fluid.
And which I think, again, the first airport to really start using recycled that. Could you tell us a little bit about that project?
Absolutely. So where we really have taken the next level in our business partner, Inland Technologies, we are the first airport in the country to take aircraft de-icing fluid effluent and turn it into an FAA-approved aircraft de-icing fluid for reuse so that we could sell anywhere. It's an ADF that is available. It's FAA-certified, can be sprayed anywhere, just like a brand-new product from the manufacturer. And we're doing it right here in a plant on site from spent aircraft de-icing fluid that's mixed with snow, dirt, anything, that any other contaminants on the apron. We capture it. And then we run through part of the process as a distillation process, a lot like making a mineral spirits like vodka is the inside. And I've even joked that we could be making vodka or we can be making ADF. We choose to make ADF here because it's what we're using. It's what we're spraying aircraft. Although I have to think that if you could make vodka cheap enough, it would be a pretty good aircraft de-icing fluid.
Sure.
So we are also accepting fluid from other airports and we're reprocessing theirs. So all of our Type 1, which is your initial application that we spray here in Portland, is all our own manufactured product. And actually, we're looking – Inland's looking to take and perhaps make a Type 4 as well, ADF here. So then we would be full – then we'd be not only the first one to do Type 1, but the first one to do Type 4 and the first one that every bit of aircraft de-icing fluid that we sprayed here would all be from remanufactured effluent.
Well, it must be incredibly economically feasible, I would imagine, once you put it all in, that eventually it will pay for itself, because not only are you not buying a lot of Type 1, but and you're taking it in from other places and perhaps, I don't know, charging mm-hmm. for that recycling because rather than dumping it, but you're also, I suspect, you'll be at some point be able to sell it back to other places.
So we already can sell, and they're actually making a product. Inland Technologies is also selling their blue, which is the LAV processing fluid for winter, so it won't de-ice in your lav carts and in the lavs on the aircraft. Surprisingly enough, I know it's right to the bathrooms, but don't mean to go to the, but it's a great product. People don't realize that the airplanes, the blue fluid in the winter, you need it to be anti-icing.
Right.
So we're also selling that product. We're not business nirvana would be where we pay nothing, so to speak, or we completely offset our reprocessing costs with the sales and to ourselves and to other markets. Right now, we're not quite there, but I think we're getting very close to the nearest alternatives, which would be like large aeration ponds, because you'd still have to process this or send your ADF effluent through to a sewer system. The Portland sewer system could not handle our fluid. I mean, that would be a very cost-effective if you could just trickle it back to the sanitary sewer. You wouldn't put all this infrastructure that we have in Portland. But we couldn't. Portland's doing their combined sewer outflow. There's a lot of demands right now, and they couldn't handle our oxygen demand for breaking down propylene glycol, which is the prime ingredient of ADF. So very interesting, yeah, overall.
It's an amazing project, and it always fascinates me. You know, the state of Maine is a very environmentally friendly state overall, and the fact that many people criticize airports and air travel as being environmentally unfriendly, which when it comes down to it, it's not, based on the number of people that are being moved for the amount of carbon or whatever that's being released. But the airport itself has been very environmentally friendly in terms of the things that it's done.
And we're putting up a large solar array over the next few months on top of our parking garage.
That was the next question I had. What other environmental things are going to be going on here?
So really pleased, teaming with the FAA on a brand new type of program, or not brand new, but a newer program, and they partner with airports to do sustainable projects. And we were able to get funded a large over 30,000 square feet of solar panels on top of our parking structure.
30,000 square feet?
Yes, it's the entire. There's a large, for those that have been here, there's a large canopy on the back third of the parking garage, and that will handle over 60% of our rental car, parking garage, electrical loads moving forward. So it's just really brilliant, and that's that offsets. And if you were to compare it to our entire electrical loads, that's 7%. But it's just the start. By 2022, every major manufacturer of automobiles will be making electric vehicles.
That's true.
So it's a good spot to have some solar capacity and extra, because where will they be plugging in the future?
Very, very true. Very, very good long sight there.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about some of the physical changes here, some of the also other changes that you brought about is that you've changed the perspective of people living in the area in terms of where they're going to fly from. Back in the when you first got here, when people were flying long distance, they'd think, okay, well, I'll go to Boston and I'll fly from there. I'll go to Manchester and I'll fly from there later on when Southwest came into Manchester. But now people don't really consider that so much. They're flying from Portland. You brought in a lot of new airlines and a lot of new service, including yesterday. Frontier just started service out of – today is – as we're recording this, it's July 11th. It was yesterday that Frontier started flying and started their first service to Denver, bringing in an A321neo.
Yay!
With Pratt & Whitney geared turbofans. One of our airplane geeks producers used to work for Pratt & Whitney, so we're really happy with those geared turbofans.
Unbelievable technology.
It's great. So how were you able to bring all these people who used to travel all over the place home to Portland?
So we came up with a vision statement, and it was to be the airport of choice for Maine. And when we came up with that vision statement, the airport of choice for Maine was unfortunately Logan. And it's really, there has to be a value proposition to the passenger, and we recognize that it had to be convenience. And part of that earlier expansion that I spoke about, we were trying to put too many people through a checkpoint that was not, didn't have enough queuing area, didn't have enough of what I like to call the recombobulation area in this post 9/11 security environment. That it takes a lot. It takes space. You want to sit down, put your shoes back on, get your belt back on. In some airports in this country, bigger airports, I won't name them, but I'm hopping on one foot with a shoe in one hand, and people are coming by you on both sides, and you're trying to grab your bag. So we wanted to be the convenient, customer-friendly airport. But that isn't good enough if you're not connected to the world. And aviation service isn't just about one carrier three times a week. It has to be about getting the passengers every day to the major metropolitan markets and the world on a schedule, have a frequency of service every day so that we can meet the business needs. And then in doing so, we'll also meet the leisure traveler needs. Really impressive to have all three international alliances, One World, Star, and SkyTeam. Just brilliant. You truly can get anywhere in the world from the Portland International Jetport. That doesn't mean that we're everything for everyone, but in general now, I believe we have the overall convenience, service, and appropriate level of air service and connectivity to meet the majority of needs for people. And we have to understand, at the end of the day, the passengers we service, they only want one thing, to come to Portland or Maine. So we're not selling transportation to any other location, really. We're the Portland International Jetport, and we're in Maine. So if you aren't coming to Maine, you won't be using us. If you are coming to Maine, we hope you do. And we want to have all the products and services and the frequency of market, the aircraft, the airlines in place to make it a great trip.
And what's amazing, you know, you said you can get any place in the world, and that's true. You absolutely can get any place in the world from Portland, but you can get to most places in the world with just one stop.
It's unbelievable. So we look at all the major Eastern Seaboard hubs. What's the largest airport in the world? Atlanta. Wait, we go there nonstop. Chicago, nonstop. Newark, nonstop. LaGuardia, nonstop.
JFK.
JFK, sure. Nonstop. There are, for an MSA, a metropolitan statistical area of just over 500,000 people, we are really blessed, and I believe the Portland International Jetport is just a reflection of a really vibrant Maine in greater Portland region. It's unbelievable. I am amazed. If you take other MSAs of 500,000 people, they have nowhere near the level of service that the Portland International Jetport has. And I'm also shocked even by, people don't realize, $500 million in airline tickets are sold out of Portland every year, out of the Portland International Jetport. People don't realize the scale. We are a small airport. We vary from 88th to 92nd largest in the country. But that's the level of business activity. I love to say that we built this great terminal expansion and it was $75 million. That's less than the value of one plane out there. So the commitment by these airlines to be here and put their valuable assets in their market, I'm so amazed that the community and the business here keep them full.
And there's an incredible amount of support for the airport. And we've discovered that all the time whenever we get a new airline coming in. And there's a lot of positive response about it in the community. But there's also, as I discovered a few weeks ago when we met the last time we were together, I attended a noise advisory committee meeting in South Portland, and I found it, as an airplane geek, extremely frustrating. And I'm not an expert as you are, but I found it frustrating, so I can't imagine how you were feeling about some of that. Some of the people there, they purchase property so close to the airport and directly under existing flight paths, and then they complain about airport noise. That frustrates me. It really does. But what I also found interesting, and I'm going to ask you to speak to noise, is that when I did a little research and I brought it up at the meeting, that in the airport surrounding area, there's over 100,000 people living here. There was a total of 442 noise complaints last year of 100,000 mm-hmm. people. Of those 442 noise complaints, they came from 125 people. So that's less than 0.12% of the population complaining about noise. How do you handle noise complaints like that?
So, you know, noise is an interesting thing. And I know the aviation, you know, people that are passionate about aviation, they actually, the noise of a plane doesn't bother them, myself included. And Micah, probably you included. Oh, that's a plane. Yay.
When our airplane geek friends are together and a plane flies by, we're all of us looking up and spotting it and figuring out what it is.
Yeah, you know? And it's wonderful. And that's amazing. And we actually have a plane spotter location on the south side of the airport over by the FBO, Maine Aviation Corp, MAC Jets. So, you know, we are still – and I agree it can be frustrating, but I also have to put myself in their position, in their shoes, that when we look overall from, you know, 1998, our operations are actually down as the aircraft get larger. And it's quieter that we're at essentially one of the quietest times for the airport in its history. But for the person that may have moved in 2010, we've grown since then. And even the FAA is recognizing that as we get quieter and quieter aircraft, the 727 that FedEx used to fly was a noisy aircraft. And it was I think there was much rejoicing when they switched to a much quieter Boeing 757. We're getting to a better place, but I found that perhaps the fact that planes and this is getting quieter – people are more in tune. And I think what maybe in the past might not have been an annoyance is an annoyance today. And actually, the FAA has recognized that, and they're doing a nationwide study that we're hoping to see the results of. They didn't tell anybody what the, I believe it was 20 airports. They didn't reveal what airports they were putting, you know, microphones out and doing all of this analysis of, because they didn't want to skew the data. And what they're trying to figure out is on noise, everybody is different, but what levels are actually the annoyance levels? And we're trying to redefine that in 2018. That said, we just talked about the geared turbofan. Over 50% quieter than the aircraft it's, the aircraft it's replacing. Unbelievable. And I think we really have a positive in aviation. Where we're going is really an incredibly bright future on noise, on fuel efficiency, even on speed. I was feeling really bad. I mean, as aviation geeks, we can all think of this was, I was becoming with the loss of supersonic travel for civilian. With the loss of the Concorde, I was part of the generation that the average speed of humans on this earth was going slower.
We took it felt like we took for the first time in our lives that we took a step backwards technologically.
Yes. Really, I mean, there's a whole variety of reasons. Within that context, though, when I was a child in the 70s, it would cost nearly as much in straight dollars. We're not talking corrected dollars to fly to Florida as it does today. I mean, a ticket back in the 70s could cost $200 to get to Orlando. I guess more of the time it was Tampa back then. Orlando's grown right, huge in the years that have come. But today, you know, it used to be only 20% of our population in this country flew in the 70s. Now it's over 80% fly regularly. So we took a step back on speed. I'm hoping we'll get back to supersonic. But at least we took a step forward on people traveling. And I know there's the side part of that is that perhaps it isn't as comfortable as it was back then as seats get tighter. But at least
available.
People are flying.
It's available. If people want the comfort, they can choose the comfort. If
Correct.
They don't want the if they want the price, they can choose the price. If the People Express democratized air travel is really what happened. And they're not here anymore, but they started it.
They were huge with the on the deregulation. And People's Express, many won't remember, they were huge here in Portland.
Yeah.
And they became Continental. And then Continental became United. So these things, it is amazing how things have changed. But Portland went from a small 200,000 employment airport and jumped very quickly to 400,000 with the help of People's Express.
I want to get back to something dealing with when you're dealing with the local communities and dealing with the noise a little bit. Something that I found just fascinating at the noise advisory meeting that I had no idea that it happened this way is that just off the end of 2911, there's a golf course, and it's a Sable Oaks golf course, and it's a great golf course, and it's been recently, the zoning has been changed to put up apartments there. Now, it's right off the end of the runway, and it's in a noise area that when the FAA did their study said it's perfect for outdoor recreation, but it's too close to the airport for apartments. And when the zoning board made this decision, when the city council made this decision, you went down and pleaded with them, please don't do this. This is going to be a terrible area for people to live. But they rezoned it anyway. When they finally build those apartments, how are we as an airport, and I say we because mm-hmm. I feel a part of it, going to deal with that and those complaints? Because there's going to be that institutional memory of saying, please don't build it there. It's going to disappear at some point.
Zoning is a huge part of any noise program, and I have to admit, I was disappointed. I know the council was in a difficult place. They're concerned, and this is South Portland. That Sable Oaks is on the South Portland side. They're very concerned about the amount of housing in South Portland, and I agree. It's we have issues, but locating, and some of these were not just apartments, but single family residences. At the end of the 1-1 approach is not okay. It was within what we call the 65 decibel day-night level average. Just the bellies are going to be 200, 300 feet over your head. This is not the place to put residential. And it's all over. And they thanked me. The council was very nice. They said, we recognize the devil's in the detail. We're going to going to rely on the developer to make quiet. But my concern is that when you get in the concern of the FAA, the concern of all of us with noise, people, you don't go into your home as a hole or as a cave. Residential units are open. They have decks. They're windows. They're not necessarily in Maine. Not all houses have central air conditioning. The majority actually do not.
Not in Maine.
So you need to open the windows in the summer. That's our busiest time. It's just not fair to the people that will be buying these properties, in my opinion, to allow that zoning to go through.
And I think if they name the area maybe Jetport Gardens, then people buying will know.
I think you and I, Micah and I, will be out there posting signs on all the realtor things saying, you are on the flight path.
what will the FAA's responsibility be there to the noise? Because, I mean, it's being built where the FAA has already said this is not a place to build.
Well, it certainly wouldn't be eligible for any noise proofing funding. So within the 65 decibel DNL, you would normally be eligible for if it was an existing home that your contours expanded from the airport due to growth or other traffic or equipment type. Some houses could be eligible for noise mitigation funds. These would certainly not be. And would have to say that these came in. I mean, on this one, it's a very clear inappropriate land use.
Yeah, I mean, if we get noise complaints from people living in that area, you kind of really at that point really want to say sorry and kind of let it go.
I think this is just a prudent thing. It should be right on the deeds.
Yeah.
I mean, they should put it on the deeds of these properties so that no homeowner could go in there, because we've given the information. The FAA has the information. The developer has the information. As far as I'm concerned, anybody that buys there, it should be written right on the deeds, and they should be aviation buffs like us.
Absolutely. One more noise question, and then I want to get on to one last thing, and it's also about Jetport expansion, too. That's great. From my perspective, Seacoast Helicopters has just brought in some local lighthouse and harbor tours for Portland for the first time ever. They're going to be flying out of Northeast Air FBO, and they're going to be using Robinson R-44 Robinson's helicopters, which are great little four-seat helicopters, and really not a particularly loud helicopter, but helicopters are loud, and there's been some speculation that and if you haven't been to the Portland, Maine area, there are beautiful islands that people live on in the harbor, and there are going to be people flying all through the harbor. There are houses all over there and probably taking tours down toward Cape Elizabeth in that area. There's probably going to be complaints. And there's also been some issues with Seacoast Helicopter with some regulations that were put in effect in New Hampshire based on the tours that were down there, based on them flying that way. What are the plans? What was the discussion with them when they came here?
So right now they are operating their main headquarters is still Portsmouth, and all of their business is still Portsmouth. So they're really testing the market, which is brilliant, and I think that's wonderful. I think this likely will be a business that has that will attract and will start to nurture. And at some point, it could be a full on campus operation. Right now, as you noted, they're working through Northeast Air, our local FBO, and it's really not a based operation, but a charter operation. So I did talk with the owner, and the first thing that I mentioned with him was noise, and we will work on patterns to get the aircraft out over non-occupied areas. So use the functionally for the buffs in the audience, our Harbor Visual approach. We could have a version of that to get them out there, which is also the beautiful spot that you want to see. You're going to see the harbor as you go out, but you're going to keep that noise focused in that location. Then as we get further out, I do agree they have ones out to Halfway Rock. I've noticed that. So we'll have to see, and we'll have to work with people if issues come up on noise. The nice thing about helicopters, they're not difficult to change the pattern. They don't have to do a runway heading 29 over South Portland. They can go anywhere we need to send them within reason, obviously. You can't send them on an inefficient pathway, but I think we can find pathways in and out. The other brilliant thing, nobody's going out in general to Halfway Rock at midnight.
That's
so
true.
We won't have these helicopters, and I haven't heard big issues, obviously, when you have a medical evac, and I haven't heard big issues. I think everybody recognizes it's life and death for our helicopters going in and out of Maine Med. So I'm hopeful that this can all work together and we can listen and make some modifications as needed to make sure they're getting their business model to work, getting the tours they need, while still being thoughtful to the neighbors. And again, me, midday with a helicopter, I'm just like, cool, that's a Robinson. I get that others may not be, especially if it's a Saturday and you're having something in your backyard and the helicopter's low and you can't talk to people there.
You know, when I attended that noise committee meeting, I found, you know, the general population just has little or no understanding or even sometimes even the desire to understand how aviation and airports work. Has the airport ever done any outreach kind of work in terms of tours, bringing people in, letting them know how things work, or set up any special programs, behind-the-scene tours or tower tours or anything open to the general public that might want to learn about that?
Mm-hmm. So that was – first, I also want to thank you, Micah, for coming to that meeting because you were a wealth of information. Obviously, as an aviation buff, lots of knowledge, I think, was shared at that meeting thanks to people like you that even us as the airport don't have all of the full range of perspective that the really passionate externals have.
Well, thank you. I felt that I could say things that needed to be said that couldn't be said in other situations or by other people.
Right. So. No, we really appreciate it. And even, making sure people knew about all the frequencies, ATC.net, that are available to listen to so you can understand why is a plane doing what it's doing. You know, go on to atclive.net. Go on to these. There's so many now that you can go on. Listen to our ATIS. It's all out there. But to your point on tours, part of that meeting was to go out into the community and help to educate on why planes fly the way they do and educate them on things like our RNAV, radio navigation departure off of, from 1-1 out to the east of the airport. Many don't know about that, and they don't know that if the crosswind component gets too high, you have to land, or even the airplanes land and take off in general into the wind. These very basic concepts aren't known. They really think it's just a quick switch that we can flip, and the plane will no longer have to go runway heading 29 from the east. And unfortunately, that is not the case. There's much more to it.
Well, it was a great meeting, and I thought that you did a wonderful education program there. And I hope that there's – I know the meetings happen every couple of times a year. I think it would be great to be able to bring people onto the airport grounds at some point or another.
And I agree with you. And what we do is we use our representatives from that noise advisory committee. So to actually go out, and Adrian, our city councilor in South Portland, who's also on our noise advisory committee – he's the one that set that meeting up, that particular meeting in South Portland. So we do hope, and we reach out to do more, and we're willing, so with your podcast, to do them here, do them in the community, meet at somebody's house to give these presentations and help to educate.
Well, the last question is this, and you may or may not be able to tell us very much, but with airlines and airports being so competitive and everything having to be kind of hush-hush, is there anything we can be, just in general, we can be looking forward to in terms of new things coming up that we can have in our hats as the airplane geeks?
Yes. I mean, if you read some of the, Wall Street Journal and these other publications, even within the past month and a half, I think they spotlighted the fact that now you can circumnavigate the globe on low-cost aviation. Huge things. We talked about the new engine option Airbus, where you can go on a two-engine aircraft, hop the pond, well, it's opened up the world to low-cost aviation, and you can stitch a ticket, circumnavigate the globe all on these. Where I'm going here is that we need to be part of that stitch. So we're looking to introduce customs here in the Portland International Jetport, reintroduce a full FIS, Federal Inspection Services facility, so that we could start to go after more of that low-cost international, which I think can give, initially, well, IAM skips down on the waterfront now. They have a connection through their Iceland, Reykjavik, lots of connectivity there, maybe opportunities on that front, other opportunities to connect to Europe, nonstop from here wouldn't be daily. We still have all that daily and frequency through our international gateways domestically that we have nonstop service to. But wouldn't it be great for us to go grab a pint in the UK on a nonstop from Portland?
We have a lot of listeners in the UK, so it's time to come visit here in Portland, Maine.
Yeah, well, let's get them here for lobster,
absolutely.
Too, and a great brew.
Paul, thank you so much for being here and part of the Airplane Geeks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great conversation, Micah. You know, one of the things that really impressed me was, and you mentioned it before, is the passion that Paul has for the Portland International Jetport and his job and for aviation. I mean, sometimes you think that an airport director can be more of a business person than, you know, an enthusiast, let's say. But he really kind of demonstrates how having that excitement, you know, for the job that he has translates into how that operation is run.
He's just a very dynamic man and really does love aviation and loves the Jetport, and his heart and soul is in it. And what fascinates me, too, about his love of aviation is, you know, we talked about there in the beginning, his background. He's a mechanical engineer, and he came to the airport as an engineer, and now he's a director, and now he publicizes the airport, lives it, breathes it, and truly does love it. What a great guy.
Yeah, I think he represents a good role model for, you know, for other airports. But there's some developments in the news, aren't there, Micah?
Yeah, when we closed it out, I asked Paul what was happening at the airport and what he could tell us, and he, you know, gave us a couple of ideas. But then, just about a week later, the airport received over $3.8 million from the airport improvement program, and they're going to be able to expand the apron. And they didn't say exactly why, but they did say they're changing it from macadam, from asphalt to concrete, so that it can hold heavier aircraft. So maybe what Paul was talking about will come true sometime soon.
And Micah, doesn't this also show the value of community relations that an airport should have with the community, and just when that's missing, how bad things can go wrong? Like, for example, by me, Santa Monica Airport, and when things go right, and how other airports, the community, so, or the airport so involved with the community, and they end up getting additional money and make improvements and really contribute to the local economy.
They really do. And Portland Jetport does a great job at outreach to the community, and I think the community appreciates it. There are those that obviously don't, that live right under flight paths, etc., and so on, but the majority of the community really likes having it here.
All right, a little bit of what's up with the geeks, and we'll do it with the geeks that we have here. Binet, it's been kind of a while since we talked to you last. What can you tell us about your recent aviation activities?
I've been busy. I've been busy writing a lot about travel and airline-based credit cards. That's my new beat. So I'm learning a lot about that side of the industry, which I did not know was so lucrative and so interesting. So that's been an education, and I've really been enjoying that. So that's what's been keeping me really busy.
So Binet, what's...
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. I did get to go in June. I went to the United Airlines Mileage Plus Exclusives event, where the people, the big rollers, bid on the chance to go to the United Asset Management facility in Tupelo. And they're in the process now of recycling United's last four 747s, including the very last one that flew, the one we all flew over to Hawaii.
Ah.
So there was an event there. That was amazing.
And I wasn't invited.
It wasn't an invitation. You had to bid. So, and I guess the bidding was quite spirited, because when some of my friends found out that I went, they were wondering how many miles I had bid, and I was actually there writing about it. So Ben Mutzebau was there, and there was a guy, from the Points Guys, and Scott McCartney from the Wall Street Journal was there too.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Do we have the picture of the Queen of the Skies on the Queen of the Skies?
There are several pictures. I will send over a link, but yes.
Very good.
That's great.
Micah, anything? I've been seeing some photos of, I don't know, I think you've been meeting up with a few people.
Well, I did attend the Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In. It was sponsored by EAA Chapter 141. And in fact, I've got some recordings from that that I'll send in to you, and hopefully we'll be able to play them for for everybody in a couple of weeks. And that was a lot of fun. But I've got to say that the past 2 weeks and this week have been the most exciting and the most depressing I've had in a long time, because Riyadh was going on, Farnborough was going on, and as we're recording this, Oshkosh is going on, and I'm not in any of them.
Yeah. And Brian, how about you? An event that you attended recently, I think.
Yeah, there have been several things that have been going on, some good, some bad. And the reason why I haven't been on the show in quite some time, so my mom was in the hospital, which was kind of a big deal, but she's out and she's fine now. Listener Hendrick and his new fiance were vacationing, or they were doing their honeymoon in Hawaii, and they stopped by Los Angeles, and I took off some time, and we got together, and I did a four-hour grand tour of Los Angeles, and had an awful lot of fun with them.
Great.
And one of the big projects that I've been working on, the 3D printing project, I can officially announce it because we're officially in beta, and so it's public information now. So the website is called craftplicator.com, and it's the first of a series of products that we're doing that enables people to get objects into the game of Minecraft, but also out of the game of Minecraft, and either build them with Legos or 3D print them. And the whole concept behind the company called Explicator is being able to do on-demand personalized manufacturing. And just with a Craftplicator, it's really a proof of technology concept for us. We've been hard at work on that, and that's been taking a tremendous amount of my time. But when I'm not hanging out at work, I got to go to the Compton Airport, and Robin Petgrave, who was on our show on episode 294, did an event at his museum at the airport, and he took a DC-3 and converted it into a food truck. And there was a ribbon cutting ceremony for this, and it was an awesome event. And I'm really embarrassed, having lived in Los Angeles for 30 some years now, I didn't even know there was an airport in Compton, let alone having an aeronautical museum, let alone having this fantastic food. Well, I get a pass on the food truck since it's brand new. But what a great place. If you're in Southern California, I highly recommend people to come do a fly-in to the airport. And they're doing really top quality food. And like everything's $10 or less. It's really inexpensive, but just such a novel idea. And I believe it's every Wednesday. They're doing kind of like a throwback event where they'll have performers from the 40s, and they're doing swing dancing and music. And they're really turning the airport into a community center, a destination in and of itself.
Brilliant.
And just absolutely fantastic.
Now, this is the forward end of the DC-3, right?
Yeah, but the flight deck's still there. So they have the co-pilot seat. But yeah, just aft of the flight deck, they've converted a good portion of it into a food truck, and they put it on the ramp. And I must say, Robin's truly an amazing guy. And I encourage people to go back to listen to episode 294, and we should really have him on the show again. Just how he's being involved in the community and giving back. At the museum, they're also doing training for students. So if you're anywhere, I think from 11 to 21, you can join one of the programs. And if you want to become a pilot, if you don't have the means to become a pilot, he'll figure out a way to have you do flight school and become a pilot for either fixed wing or helicopter. They're doing a space program where they're doing model rockets. And actually on this Saturday, I'm going to go out to the launch site and we're going to go launch some model rockets. They have a pipistrel And he's planning on building 4 electric charging stations in around Southern California, so you could take electric aircraft and fly around and be able to charge it. Just the stuff that he is doing is absolutely amazing. And yeah, hats off. Talk about a positive airline story. Although this is an airline, he definitely is winning in my book for doing the right thing, getting the community involved, and really giving back and supporting the kids. And it's really fantastic.
Cool.
I did an interview with Robin back when I was still working at AOPA. And like you, I did not know that there was an airport in Compton, and wrote a great story about it. And just amazing work that he was doing back then. So I'm just glad to see that he's still at it.
Some of these airports that we keep running across are just getting it so right these days. It's really exciting to hear. But Brian, you have an announcement for us.
I do. Yeah, this is going to be a hard piece for me. So indulge me for a few minutes. I look at life as though it's a metaphor of a book, and books are made up of chapters. And I view this, I view my life as a series of chapters. Just to name a few, growing up in New Jersey was my first chapter. Attending college was a different chapter. Moving to California, starting my career was yet another. Being associate producer of the Airplane Geeks has been the most current chapter of my life. And like all chapters in my life, it's time for this one to come to an end. So therefore, it's with great sadness in my heart that I make the announcement today that I close this chapter of my life. All good things must come to an end, and this has truly been a spectacular series of great things that have made up this chapter of my life. As our main man Micah has said many times, we are family, and I feel like I have made so many new friends and family members. In addition, I absolutely love this job and the opportunity to express my narcissistic tendencies. I love the experiences my association with the Airplane Geeks podcast has afforded me and the people that I've met along the way. There are way too many to mention, and I'm going to miss some for sure, so my apologies in advance if you're not mentioned. The show has enabled me to travel around the world with notable trips to South Africa, visiting Francois and his game farm, Tabutalo. Gosh, I hope I pronounced that correctly. To Germany, where listener Tillman hosted me at a circus hotel. Not that the hotel was a circus. It's called the Circus Hotel and Brewery. Had great meetups with Matt, Hendrick, Marcus from the Omega Tau podcast, Jan, Christoph, so many. It was such a great time. Twice I was able to travel to England, where I met the fine folks of the Plain Talking UK podcast, and they took care of me oh so well. So I can't thank Carlos and Matt and Nev enough for their hospitality and friendship. I also got to meet Pilot Pip, Captain Al, Mila, Barbara, so many others from the Plain Talking UK family. There was also the Wings Over Pittsburgh air show that was hosted by listener Captain Rick Bell. It's such a great time with all of our listeners and fellow podcast friends. There was, of course, the captains, Jeff, Nick, and Al. Dr. Steph was there. Matt and Carlos from Plain Talking UK. And to toot my own horn, I did have a little bit to do with Matt showing up on the trip across the pond. So sorry, Matt, you had to fly in United and in a 757. But now you know better. And knowledge is important. So you don't have to do that again. Captain Rick, thank you from the bottom of my heart for all the hard work you put into making that such a great show. And I am going to speak for everyone. Everyone did have a fantastic time. I'm also looking forward to meeting our Down Under friends in New Zealand and Australia later on this year. I really hope that trip stays intact and doesn't fall apart. But before I forget, there are great events that I was able to participate in California, the air show in Miramar, the Planes of Fame air show in Chino, the ribbon cutting ceremony in Chino, just to name a few. They're definitely the great co-hosts and contributors I get to work with every week. Micah and Launchpad, your contributions to the show really add value. Please keep up the great work. I look forward to meeting Launchpad sometime in the future. Micah, again, I can't thank you enough for taking care of the ground while you allow me to take care of the air.
It's a long story.
Yeah. Rob, I definitely miss Rob, but I'm happy we still get to keep in touch outside of the show. I had such a great time with you at the NBAA show in Vegas and hope I could ride on your coattails again sometime soon. It's definitely fun hanging out with a rock star. Max West, got to thank you for the flight in the SR-22 and letting me experience what it's like to always stay ahead of the airplane. I love the way you teach, the way you plan, the way you talk through your next move before you have to make it. It was great flying with you and holding up a United 777 on the runway at San Francisco. That was great fun. David, I hope your health holds out and you have a long, happy life. I must admit, though, I had to check up on you with one of our guests. On episode 507, you were so talkative, which is really unusual for you on the show, and you went on and on about a few different topics, topics that our guest clearly knew more about than anyone else. So after a few days, after the show was over, I contacted Colonel Graham and asked him if you were accurate or if he was way too polite to correct you on the show. He wrote back to me, and to quote what he wrote, it's, David did an excellent job with his comments, and he was quite accurate at the same time. So, David, you continue to amaze me and impress me with your knowledge. Thank you for being you. And then there's Max. I know I've said it before, and I'll continue to say it. I have so much respect and admiration for you and what you do on the show on a weekly basis. It takes so much time, effort, and energy. I have no idea how you did this all these years while you were working, and now that you're not, you've picked up doing even more shows. I still have no idea how you have the time for it all. Your stamina, dedication to do this every week for 10 years, it just blows me away. And you definitely have made a positive contribution to the aviation community. I'm so proud to have been able to serve on the show. I really wish this was a paying gig, as I would love to do this full-time. There is most certainly enough work to turn this into a full-time job, but the pay simply doesn't justify the time. Therefore, we all do this out of a passion for aviation and for our listeners. You guys, our listeners, are truly great and the reason why we do what we do. I'm very proud of the show and the very small contribution that I've made to it. I love the fact that we promote women in aviation. And in my opinion, there should be more women in aviation.
Yeah.
And people, Binet, you're going to love this one then. And people like Akbar Al-Baker of Qatar should be driven from the industry with their male-centric ideas and attitudes. I'm very proud of the variety and quality of guests that we've been able to bring to the show. In particular, I'm so very proud of the fact that I was able to get former NASA Administrator Major General Charlie Bolden on the show. Not once, but twice. There have been so many other great guests, but getting Charlie on the show was really special to me. I know I've gone on for way too long, but I'd like to close with a following written by Eric Baker. These are the four harsh truths that will make you a better person. You are going to die. You have a deadline, literally, so focus on what matters and make sure to celebrate the good times. I'd rather have a shorter, awesome life than a long, lousy one. Anything worthwhile takes more than what you think. Ever fuss around an entire Sunday not truly having fun and not truly accomplishing anything? And then you say, what the heck did I do all day? Well, you don't want to be saying that at the end of your life. Embrace the challenges and find meaning. You will never be perfectly happy, and you don't need to be. Insisting on complete happiness is the surest way to stay unhappy. Be grateful for what you have and gently reach for a little more. The last one, people will let you down. You're allowed to insist on others being perfect the day you become perfect, which is never. People will cause you problems, but they will also be the greatest source of happiness. 5-to-1 is plenty good. So with that, the four harsh truths, which I hope will make you all better people. Thank you all for allowing me to write this chapter of my life. I will forever be grateful and look forward to seeing where you characters appear in future chapters in the book of my life. Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Brian, because I think people don't completely appreciate or are aware of all of the sort of behind the scenes things that that you've done to help put this show together. And I'm talking about finding guests, scheduling guests, preparing guests, teaching them what Skype is and how to use it, and how to sound their best with either the microphones they have or what you can convince them to procure. So it's really a lot of work. It's been a lot of work. So when you talk earlier about your small contribution, by no means has it been small. So we want to thank you for that. We'll miss you. You're not going to disappear completely, are you?
No, I definitely plan on staying around as a contributor at large, and I have some events that I'm looking forward to doing. For example, the air show in Huntington Beach is coming up. The show in Miramar is coming up. We've talked about going over to Dubai and doing that air show. So there is definitely a lot of events coming up that I absolutely want to participate in and be able to do field reporting. It's just with everything else that's been going on in my life, I just can't take the time any longer to dedicate to doing a good job. And as soon as my performance in the job starts to slip, that I feel bad for the show, and I just hate letting you guys down. So
I'm very, very sad, Brian. I'm sad for me, but not so much for me. I mean, you've been such a great friend, and the friendship isn't going to end. And, you know, if it weren't for you, I never would have made it to Farnborough when we went together. But because you were the one that convinced me and gave me that call in February, and you're to blame. But I'm not so sad about the friendship, because the friendship's going to continue. We'll still be in touch. We'll still do things together, and we'll still visit and play together. But I'm sad for our listeners, because many of our listeners aren't going to have that opportunity, and I can only imagine how they must be feeling now, because that's how I would be feeling if it weren't that we'll still be together. So thank you for everything you did for the show and for me, and you'll be missed.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Yep, absolutely. All right, well, you're not off the hook completely yet, Brian.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, you have a shout-out, I think, for us.
I do. Now, keep in mind that the bit that I just went through, if you couldn't tell, I was actually reading it. But I also have another shout out, and it's kind of a long story. And please keep in mind that these two events are separate, but they're equally as meaningful. And this one is entitled "Mental Health is a Serious and Important Topic." And as Rob Marr can confirm, not because he has mental issues, well, maybe he does, we don't know, but because his wife practices in the field, this is really an important, serious topic. Although not a mental issue, I've had several issues to overcome in my life. From the time I could walk until the day before I started school, I had to wear leg braces due to a rotated hip and turned leg. I couldn't run or play with any of the other kids because I had braces, and to this day, I still have chronic pain in my right hip. Growing up, I also had a speech impediment, and it prevented me from speaking in complete sentences, something I still suffer from to this day, believe it or not. The way I've overcome this challenge is to sing every sentence I speak. Therefore, in addition to having to think about what I'm going to say, I also have to think about singing it. And trust me, this is exhausting. If you are around me late at night or when I've been drinking, you'll definitely notice. And if I don't sing, most of the time, words simply don't come out of my mouth, which is something you might think is a good thing.
Not
I had
true.
No idea. This is, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's definitely an issue for me.
Huh.
I also have on and off been suffering from depression. And it's not something that I've talked about or share with people, but I feel as though since this is my last show as a regular co-host, I could do it. So a little bit ago, getting back to the mental health, I considered taking my own life. Now, before you get all upset, the story has a very happy ending. I'm still here, right? Anyway, I'm not here to talk about my issues or my challenges per se. What I wanted to do is give a shout out to the podcasting community and ask for your support. By listening to podcasts, and I'm talking about all podcasts, not just Airplane Geeks or Airline Pilot Guy or Plane Talking UK or all the other great aviation podcasts, I was actually listening to a discontinued podcast that saved my life. So I told you this was a serious and important topic.
Mm.
Anyway, the podcast is produced by this great company called Gimlet Media, and the show is called Undone. The particular episode that saved my life is entitled The Columbia. Some of you may have listened to it, and if you haven't, please do me a favor and listen to the podcast. I've asked Max to put the episode URL in the show notes. In addition to giving the show a listen, please support content producers of the great shows that you love listening to. These shows cost time, money to produce, and even if you think they don't need the money, I could pretty much guarantee you that they do. And if you can't afford to contribute financially, please give them a rating in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. Also, please tell your friends about the podcasts and how great they are. The ratings and reviews really help. And I'm still amazed how many people don't know what podcasts are, let alone listen to them. Therefore, a great way of helping and supporting your favorite shows are to tell your friends about them and encourage them to listen and contribute financially if they can. You can also send a simple email or provide some feedback to the show. I'm certain the people will appreciate hearing from you just as much as we at the Airplane Geeks appreciate hearing from you. So with that, I wanted to share with you the particular moment of the show Undone, The Columbia, that saved my life. It's a short little clip, but it made a huge impact on me. And the setup for the clip is the description that's found in their show notes. In 2003, the Space Shuttle Columbia was returning from 2 weeks in orbit. It was a routine mission, so routine that most Americans barely paid attention, until something went terribly wrong. Many of us watched the shuttle break apart over Texas on television. All seven of the crew members were lost. John Clark's wife, Laurel, was one of them, and her death that day inspired his life's work, getting more people into space. So please, help inspire others by supporting your favorite podcasts. You just might end up saving a life and doing something really important along the way. This is Brian Coleman, your former associate producer and now contributor at large of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Max, if you could play that little segment, I'd really appreciate it.
You can hear it in John's voice when he talks about this stuff. He really does just think space exploration is awesome. That's not true of everybody Laurel left behind. Her son Ian has no interest in spaceflight. It took his mom from him, after all. And John gets that. After Laurel died, John says he stopped taking as many risks, worried about leaving Ian with no parents. He gave up flying small airplanes, for instance. But Ian is grown up now. And even though John probably knows more about the dangers of spaceflight than just about anyone else on Earth, he says if he got the chance, he'd go.
Shoot, yeah. I don't care how risky it is. I don't care if it's a guarantee that I would die. I would still do it. I'd go to Mars tomorrow.
That one simple line from John changed my life.
Amazing. The episode is really fascinating, and when I started listening to it, it just grips you. And it's an amazing story that comes from the loss of the space shuttle Columbia and what this man did in response to losing his wife on that space shuttle. So look for that in the show notes. It's called The Columbia. And again, it's from Gimlet Media, from the Undone podcast, which is no longer being produced, but this is This is a great listen. All right, we've talked about our Slack listener team. You've heard us talk about that. And Dave Homewood, who produces the Wings Over New Zealand podcast, had an interesting post in there. And he told a little story. And I asked him if he would record it for us so we could play it for all of you. So here's Dave Homewood.
Hey, airplane geeks. It's Dave Homewood here from the Wings Over New Zealand show. I was really taken by the story that Peter Johnson told in his recent Across the Pond in Airplane Geeks episode 512, where he went along to the Ovalton Air Show and thoroughly enjoyed not taking photographs, not recording, not doing anything, but just watching. And I must say that, you know, I'm someone who is very fortunate to get a number of media passes for events here through Wings Over New Zealand. And so I'm always, you know, taking photographs or filming or recording interviews and various things for the forum and for my show. And I had a similar experience to what Peter had last year by pure accident. I didn't decide to do it. And that was at the 80th anniversary of the Royal New Zealand Air Force Air Show at Ohakia. It's kind of stupid, but I went down to the air show with my best mate and best mate Mike, and we arrived at the car park, and because of the problems that they'd had 5 years before with the 75th anniversary air show, where there was massive traffic problems, they decided that the car parks would all be quite a few kilometres away from the airbase, and there would be just buses going between the car parks and the airbase, so that there would be no traffic problems on the main road. And so we pull up at the car park and we're chatting away, get out of the car, we hop onto one of these shuttle buses and we start rolling along towards Ohakia airbase, when I looked down and thought, oh no, I haven't got my camera. I'd left it in the car. I don't know how I managed to do it, but I did it. And so we arrive at Ohakia airbase, and I was thinking originally I'll just jump back on one of the buses, go back to the car park and then come back. But then I suddenly thought, well, hang on, the air show is going to start any minute, probably within the next 20 minutes. What's going to be the opening act, and will it be one of the overseas jets that I haven't seen before and I don't want to miss? So we didn't know what the program was, and so I decided to hang around and just see the beginning, and then I'd find out what was coming up, and I'd then jump on the bus and go back and get the camera, which would probably have taken half an hour to get back to the car park and then get the camera and get on another bus back to the airfield. So by this stage, we'd caught up with two more of my friends, and the four of us were just chatting and enjoying it, and we watched the beginning of the air show, and then every now and then one of them or two of them would say, Dave, you're going to go get your camera? And I'd say, oh yeah, in a minute. Yeah, I'm just enjoying this at the moment. And it got to the point where I was like, no, I'm not even going to go back. I'm not even going to go get the camera. I don't want to miss anything. Plus, I'm just really enjoying not photographing, not just watching the whole show through my lens. So that's what I did, and I have no photographs of my own from the event, and I've got no recordings, nothing. I just have really good memories, and it was so different to just kick back and chat with my mates and you know, really enjoy the show and on a whole different level. So I totally see where Peter is coming from. And I would recommend to anybody who is always at an air show behind a camera, just try it once. Don't take the camera. Put it down. Leave it at home. Leave it in your car like I did. and have a go. You know, you'll find a whole different experience, I think. I certainly did, and I know that Peter did. So I will say this, though. I haven't managed to forget my camera at subsequent air shows. I always make sure that I'm not that stupid again, but I do take time to just put the camera down and watch certain acts and really take it in properly. So yeah, that's my story. Cheers.
Thanks, Dave. It's enjoy the show, right? Sometimes you just have to enjoy the show.
Yeah, you definitely have a different perspective without focusing through a lens, or even the shows that I've done. It seems like I'm running around trying to get the next interview and worried about the recording equipment. You really miss out on the show. So
yep.
I'm really happy to hear that these guys have kind of gotten back to the roots and are just enjoying the show for the sake of an air show. That's awesome.
Now, Dave also wrote us concerning episode 512. He said, "The discussion with Dan Snyder about aerial firefighting is completely fascinating, and it's especially interesting to hear how good the BAE-146 Whisper Jet is in that role." Now, he said, "One question that occurred to me while listening to this Airplane Geeks episode is, do the pilots use flight simulators that simulate specific fire conditions or flying challenges to help them prepare for the real thing? Or can it only be learned on the actual job?" So we asked Dan, and Dan came back and said, "Aircraft-specific training is completed in a Level D simulator. There's nothing different in the sim from standard airline or corporate full-motion simulators. Every 2 years, IA-qualified captains attend NAF for fire and mission training." And there's a website for that, nafri.gov. "The rest of the training is done in the aircraft booth in simulated missions and on active fires." Now, this nafri.gov, the National Advanced Fire and Rescue Resource Institute, or NAFRI, I guess you might call it, is a national-level training center. This is from their website. "National-level training center serving the interagency wildland fire community through the development and implementation of fire, fuels, resource, and incident management skills and educational processes." So that was interesting to learn about. And then Dave also asked, "Has there ever been a fly-on-the-wall documentary or series following the lives and adventures of these firefighters?" And Dan answered that one as well. And I'll mention that Dan was happy to answer these questions. He said, "There have been a couple of short dramataries," he called them. I love that term, dramataries, in quotes, "done about aerial firefighting. Almost all of them try to over-dramatize the job and mission and don't really accomplish a true documentary." He said, "There are more interviews and the like out there. However, there is one that was done with Flying Magazine. This is Flying Tankers is a Job for True Airmen." We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And Dan also said that Neptune also has some YouTube videos, and we'll put a link to the YouTube videos from Neptune in the show notes. So if you really want to get some more of this firefighting, aerial firefighting, you'll be able to do that there.
And, you know, there was a terrible film that included, well, I don't know if it was terrible, but a film from 1989 that was a romantic comedy drama directed by Steven Spielberg that included aerial firefighting. Do you remember that one? Always?
Always. No, with, I don't. Yes.
With Richard Dreyfuss, yeah, Holly Hunter, and John Goodman?
Yes.
Now, it's not a great film about aerial firefighting, but it does show when how Dan talked about how they, you know, used to use old kind of a ragtag motley crew of retired Air Force aircraft. Well, there's an A-26 in it and all sorts of other great aircraft that that are used in it, and it's before they used to make all the special effects with cartoons. They use real airplanes.
All right, well, we need to wrap this one up. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank Micah and Aunt Benet, the aviation queen, Benet Wilson, for joining us this episode. Benet, tell our listeners where they can follow you, where they can learn more about you online.
Well, I am on Twitter at AvQueenBenet. Love to hear from people there. I'm on Instagram. I've been having fun with Instagram as Aviation Queen. You can see my work at MagnifyMoney.com and CompareCards.com. And I'm on Facebook, Aviation Queen. So wherever you want to hit me up, I'm there.
Micah, our main man, If folks would like to get in touch with you, where do they find you?
Well, I'm on Twitter, and that's the only place where I have a social presence, and that's at MaineFly, and that's Maine, M-A-I-N-E, like the state, MaineFly. And then you can reach me here at the Airplane Geeks at Micah, M-I-C-A-H. That's Micah at airplanegeeks.com.
Terrific. And Brian, you don't get to fade completely away. So if folks want to reach you.
Yeah, you're still keeping my email address alive. So yes. People can send me emails at brian@airplanegeeks.com. They could also find me, it seems like most days, at the United Club at LAX when I'm coming to and fro. So and definitely looking forward to being seen on the Singapore air flight from Newark to Singapore come October.
Oh, that'll be great. I'd love Singapore.
All I've got to say is it's the favorite flight I never flew.
Right.
That was a great story.
And again, Brian, thank you so much for all that you've done. We'll look forward to staying in touch and hearing from you in the future. And you can find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. Look for me on LinkedIn. I also produce with David Vanderhoof the UAV Digest each week. Find that at the UAVDigest.com. If you can't remember that, just go to DronePodcast.com. And also with Mary Kirby on PaxXPodcast.com. Our outro music is by Bruno Massone. Find more of his work at BrunoMassone.com. And I'll ask all of you to please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Bye-bye.
And for David, thanks for listening.